Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. Our guest today is Brian Klarhart, the manager of Nyköping BIS, a club in the Swedish third division, and I believe the only American head coach in Europe right now other than David Faulkner, the former U.S. international who coaches Huddersfield. Brian is 32 years old. Brian, thanks for joining the pod. Let's start with where you are. Nyköping, a town of 32,000, about an hour south of Stockholm. What's it like there?
Well, thanks for having me, Adam. Nyköping, it's a pleasant town. It's right on the Baltic Sea, about an hour from Stockholm, like you said. It's a quaint, small town with a nice harbor and right in front of the archipelago. So it's a calm atmosphere and a lot of good nature right outside the city. And it's a quiet place. It has a lot of things to offer, and it's in a pretty good location in the country.
Yeah, I did a little Googling, and it looks beautiful. Cobblestone streets, little shops, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's definitely it's a big summer town. A lot of people have their vacation or holiday houses there in the summer, and in the summer months it starts to pick up in population. And so I've been there for a few years thus far.
Okay, let's talk about your background. Where did you grow up, and how did you fall in love with soccer?
Yeah, I grew up about 30 minutes outside Philadelphia in South Jersey. Originally grew up in the town Cherry Hill, and then my family located a few towns over to Medford, New Jersey. And really how I got involved with soccer and playing, I was a hyperactive kid and 4 years old running around the house, and my parents, you know, signed me up for the local youth soccer. My dad was involved in coaching me up to a certain age, and I used that energy on the field, and I took to it and fell in love with it. And it's been my passion since I've been 4 years old. And then my little brother kind of followed in my footsteps, and he became a goalkeeper because I needed someone to shoot on in the backyard. And it's kind of been like that. So it's involved my family. We're a typical American soccer family in the United States. And that's kind of the start of it.
Great. So you played in high school, obviously, and in college at St. Peter's. Is that right?
Yeah, in St. Peter's, up in outside New York City. I transferred high schools, went to Shawnee High School in Medford, New Jersey, and it was Medford produces a lot of good players. We had a few players at that time going to the MLS and USL, and I think we finished number two in the nation when I transferred in as a public school, which is pretty good. So you know, it's kind of a pretty good soccer community in that area, especially where we're from.
Yeah. So what position did you play? What kind of player were you?
Yeah, you know, I was a pretty creative player, probably too much. I kind of really liked the street soccer aspect of things, and probably tried to do too much crap and certain parts of the field that my coaches didn't like and things that I probably wouldn't like. But I was more of a, you know, an inverted winger, central midfielder, that really looked at the creative side of the game, and maybe at that time was a little bit too creative, and that's why probably my career did not pan out to where I would want it to be. But that's kind of, I was always interested, always, you know, with the ball at my feet in the front yard constantly for hours, and pretty technical, and kind of focused on that a bit.
So maybe that gives you a soft spot for players like that a little bit as a coach?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely, even, you know, whether it was in the U.S. or in Sweden, you kind of like guys that try different things. And yeah, I definitely do have a soft spot for that a bit. Certain guys that are quicker on the feet and are a little bit more creative. Yeah, that's in certain aspects of positions that I look at moving forward. I do appreciate that. So that, yeah, it's true.
You were an assistant coach at the Stevens Institute, which is also just outside New York City, and then UConn, and then Temple. And I don't, you know, if you want to get into detail on any of those, I'm happy to do that. But I'm most interested in how did you end up going from Temple to Sweden? Because that seems like quite a leap.
Yeah. Like I said, St. Peter's is pretty close to Hoboken, New Jersey, and there was a Division III school that was a top Division III school in Hoboken. I think they were in the national championship the year before I came with Coach Tim O'Donohue, and he remembered me as a player and brought me on staff. And after a year at Stevens, he ended up going to UConn, and I ended up going with him to a year at UConn. I stayed at UConn for a year, and then Temple was kind of moving in the same conference, and they wanted me as a first assistant, so I came back down to Temple, and it was a lot of years on the road recruiting and traveling internationally, and, you know, I was at Temple for a few years, and I kind of saw at the University of Connecticut working under Ray Reed kind of the business side of college soccer, and after being at Temple, I kind of said to myself, you know, I'm not on the field as much as I should be in order to perfect my trade. Mm. I mean, right now I'm perfecting my trade to be a GM or a sporting director. So after about the fourth season at Temple, I was looking to see what the options were. And at that time, there weren't three levels of USL like there is now, and the options in the professional game are very limited.
Right.
And it was extremely, I was kind of at a crossroads. And luckily, during my time recruiting for Temple, I met a guy by the name of John Wall, who was the under-19 coach at AIK at the time. And we stayed in touch for a bunch of years, and we had the same philosophy on the game. And I think he's a really good student of the game and one of the better tactical minds that I've had a chance to talk to, and we kind of stayed in touch, and he called me up during this time and said, hey, I just became the head coach in New Shepping's BIS, and I'm also going to be on staff for Finland with the national team with Hans Backe, who used to be the former Red Bulls coach. Hmm. So during that time, he kind of said, well, why don't you come out here? And, you know, I need someone good to kind of when I'm on international break. And I went out to New Shepping, and it ended up working out right at the right timing. And that's kind of how it worked to get over to Sweden and work in that environment.
So is Wall an American guy, or is he?
No, he's Swedish. Okay. So.
Okay. Yeah. How did you meet him? Like, where did you guys meet and strike up a conversation?
Yeah, I think we had a mutual contact with Tim Carter, who was actually at Minnesota United in our youth academy, who kind of put us together. We met in Sweden. I was going over to Sweden to recruit and into Europe at least once a year. And we always got together and talked and shared information on different trends of the game and had a lot of conversations, and it kind of continued throughout the years. We'd see each other once a year during the recruiting months, probably around November, December, and that kind of we understood each other in a special way, which I really value.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you went to join him right at the beginning of 2017 or maybe late 2016, is that right?
Yeah, right at the beginning of 2017. Yep, that's correct.
So you, I mean, people can go on Transfer Market and look all this up, but I think it'd be helpful for you to explain, you know, what happened that season and your first season as an assistant there and how you ended up as the head coach.
Yeah, I think 2017, my first season, it was pretty interesting. We qualified for the Swedish Cup, so we had good games against Hammarby, and well, I think I came 2016 as an assistant, and then 2016.
Okay.
For a year as assistant, and then 2017 we qualified for the Swedish Cup, and going into 2017 we were pretty excited because we had a pretty good draw in the Swedish Cup. But we had Hammarby, Östersund, and Varberg in Superettan. So we started off the season in 2017, had a pretty decent showing against Hammarby. It was a close game. It was a good environment, packed house. At this time, Hammarby's in Allsvenska. Östersund, who was probably the most successful team in Sweden during that time, who made a really pretty significant run in Europa League that year, we did okay with, and then we tied Varberg. So we're going into the season probably overconfident, our players saying, hey, we're going to steamroll through the season. We were confident with the players we had, and yeah, to make a long story short, we were happy with our play and kind of our game module. We just weren't getting results. There was a lot of ties. It was a lot of, okay, 1-1 and then losing a game 2-1 in the 94th minute, or being up 1-0. And then again, right, it was a trend in the later last 5 minutes of a game, 1-1 in extra time. And that kind of puts pressure on you, and from a psychological standpoint, in those later minutes of the game, it kind of wears on you a bit, you know, not again. And it was amazing to see that trend continue. And so after the summer break, you know, we were pretty low in the table, and I think at that time we were picked to be one of the teams in promotion, and we were low in the table, maybe in the relegation zone or right near there. Mm-hmm. And after the summer break, we had maybe not a good result, and they brought in John, and they ended up going in a different direction and brought me in and said, hey, you're now in charge of the team. And it was kind of a tough moment for me, because John was obviously the reason that I was there, and he's a guy that I value very highly. So you know, it was an interesting situation, and I had talks with John, and I said, well, you know, my contract is to continue, you know, they're not getting rid of me and paying me out. So, you know, I made the decision to stay, and he was okay with that, to take over the team, and took over the team, and we tied, we played the team leading Braga, who's up in Superettan now, tied them, and then the rest of the 8 or 9 games, we won them all and ended up finishing fourth in the table. So that's kind of how 2017 went in a nutshell. Yeah. There.
What a year for you. I mean, crazy. I mean, what gave the club front office confidence that they could trust you? You know, pretty young guy, a foreigner. Obviously, you were part of the staff of the guy who got fired.
Yeah, part of the staff with kind of the same philosophy on the game, right? So, I think you know, I did pretty well during those times. There were a few games when John was gone during international break, and we had some pretty decent results. And I think maybe some of the training and the intensity and some of the little cultural things of being American, maybe they saw that as being positive. And I think being there for that amount of time, you have to earn your respect, right? So I think I had the respect of the players and the club, and they gave me some confidence, and they said, hey, this is your shot. And I think in all coaching careers, right, you need to kind of get that shot and take advantage of it, or in players' careers as well. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a lot of good college assistant coaches who are kind of in the same boat, you know, that say, hey, you know, I'm stuck here, it's hard to get jobs, and it's the same thing in the professional game. And you know, you see it with Chris Armas this year at Red Bull, and it kind of, but you have to earn the respect from the players, I think, first and foremost, and that kind of translate to the board and to the president and to the sporting director of the club.
All right. Well, what did you change? Did you change anything when you took over? I mean, the results certainly changed. How did you do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, being an assistant coach, you can kind of take a step back visually and kind of see certain details that you would improve maybe if you're in charge and you're not in this tunnel of pressure that maybe you are in a managerial role with more responsibility. So I think I tried to really change the little details. I talked about that, building a culture, making the objectives clear, not overloading the players with too much info. I mean, at that time, we had a pretty heavy senior squad with good players. And I think, you know, at that point, you can kind of take an American influence of coaching, right? You know, I was I worked under Ray Reed at UConn, who is a pretty good, great motivator, creates great cultures within the locker room, a great standard of performance. And you can kind of take those influences, whether from American soccer or from basketball or American football, and use that within a locker room in Europe. I think there is a big undervalue of that, of the American culture and sports that is built. And you see that in Europe with the top football coaches reading about Bill Belichick and the interest in that and creating kind of that culture. So I think that experience being in those environments, right, in college soccer where, you know, you have an American football influence of culture, American basketball can be positive.
Interesting.
And translate. I do. And I think that's very undervalued with American coaches. So I think that kind of that culture and details and setting the standard of performance that, it is unacceptable to tie or lose. When I walk into the locker room, I want to hear a pin drop, and getting down to those basics and setting the performance indicators of that. So that was really the change, because like I said, the philosophy in the game module, I was happy with that. It was the other details looking from the outside in that I wanted to create a winning atmosphere and a winning culture.
Man, that's fascinating. Well, you brought Roman Gall over from the Columbus Crew in 2015, I think. No, that can't be right. 2016?
2016, yep.
And he's moved up in the past 3 years, as most of the people who listen to this podcast will know, to one of the top clubs in Sweden. How much have you been doing that, you know, moving players up through Nyköping's BIS? And how much is that a selling point when you're out there looking for players? Like your club as a pathway to better things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. This is a really interesting question, right? We brought Romain Gall in. We were looking for at that time a 10, and I have a pretty good relationship with his agent, and we didn't know really where he fit. And there was, you know, he was on loan in USL down in Texas at the time. And we brought him over, and we're like, is this guy a 10? Is he a winger? Is he up a withdrawn forward? And we brought Romain Gall in, and I think, you know, he needed to be kind of redefined tactically. And at our level, I think we have a lot of layers. Guys that come in that play for me or for John at that time, they might be challenged higher from a tactical standpoint than they are in Allsvenska, because the amount of layers and in our game module. So it was not, you know, I think when people look at our level in Superettan and Allsvenska, in those top three levels in Sweden, there is not too much of a difference. It's not like Spain, where a guy is earning in Allsvenska 10 million euros a year. There is more, there's a little bit more, it's not as big of a gap because of the payment, basically, in those three levels. So, but, you know, he did well. He produced points, and he definitely progressed very quickly. And then, you know, we spoke to Sundsvall, and he from Sundsvall, he just blossomed. And there was an amount of confidence, and I hope we contributed to his pathway, and I think we did. But in terms of using that as a selling point, yeah, I think I had an American on trial in November, and he said, yeah, you're the guy that we're talking about in the U.S. that brought Romain Gall. And it's kind of a little talk within between players in the U.S., and I was a little bit taken back by that. But
interesting.
I believe in the American player. I think they have different attributes that guys in Europe don't have, and I try to help them, and they're helping me at the same time, that I think that might be a good fit in Europe, in Sweden, that could maybe jumpstart their career. And I think it is a great selling point. We brought over Arun Basulovic, who was with Red Bull during the summer break. We brought over Coy Kraft, who's been with the U-20s with FC Dallas during the summer break. And I think it's a good selling point, not only for American players, but also for domestic Swedish players, because I think we've done a really good job, and we have produced the most guys to Allsvenskan and Superettan in these last few years from our level. So I think it's a good selling point, and I always look at it where, hey, I want us to be promoted, but I also want the players to develop and move up, and that's a great selling point moving forward. And I rely on that, and I speak about that daily when I speak to certain guys that we're interested in. So it's part of, we want guys that are ambitious. I say you have a coach that's ambitious, and we kind of show, okay, this is what happened to Romain Gall, this is what happened to Christian Kwaku, who we had. Do the business, and we'll prepare you. And our job is, when you move up to the higher levels, you're not fazed by anything. So, yeah, it's a great selling point.
Without getting into specifics, you sort of referenced this, but in general, what do players make in the Swedish third division? It's called Division Norra, right? Norra?
Division One. It's called Division One. So, it's interesting, right? So, if you look at it right from USL, right, you have certain teams like FC Cincinnati that were paying guys more than certain other clubs. You have that here as well. Okay. A team like Västerås that won the league, Victor Lindelof came from there, so they had a lot of money from the sale to Man United. So there's a lot of difference in payment depending on the club's finances, right? You can have a guy making $1,000 a month, and you can have a guy making $6,000 a month that is 32 years old and played in Serie A 3 years ago or something like that. So there is a big difference depending on the club, but yeah, like the range 1 to 6,000 a month, that's where you can kind of see the payments being distributed.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine there's quite a bit of variation on playing environments too, or home environments. I watch some Scandinavian soccer, and I see a club like Nordsjælland in Denmark could be playing FC Copenhagen, and it'll be a crowded, gigantic stadium, or they could be playing Hobro, and it'll be mostly an empty stadium. What's the third division like in Sweden when it comes to that?
Yeah, again, right? You can go play Västerås, who has a really rowdy crowd with a big support group, and that could be 7,000 to 8,000, and the stadium's bumping. And then you can go into a town that just got promoted, and there's a few hundred people. So it depends. It depends if the town's a football town or a hockey town as well. So in our league, like I said, like the payments, like the fan group, obviously the more supporters, probably the more money you have with the club as well. Right. And it can depend. But I do think, a few thousand each game is probably an average. And then when you go up to Allsvenskan, that can be some of the more intense fans in Europe, actually. If you go to a Stockholm derby versus Djurgården versus AIK, or something with Gothenburg, I mean, I brought my brother in there in the summer, and he goes, holy crap, the amount of noise and the atmosphere compared to an MLS game, it's just unbelievable. So, yeah, there is a lot of difference between that, especially at our level.
Right. Now you mentioned before we got on the call that there's quite a lot of pressure on you, even though Nyköping's BIS is not the largest club. Like, can you talk a little bit about that? I think you mentioned like your face could be on the front page of the newspaper if you guys aren't doing well.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, right? These are the professional sports teams for these towns or surrounding areas around these towns. So I think you said Nyköping had a population of 32,000. That's the city, but there's a lot of different regions around Nyköping. So, the media attention is high, and if you're not doing well, you have a few bad results, yeah, they're calling for your head on the first page of the paper. And again, with players on bigger payment, they're scrutinized. So you have to manage that, and there is pressure. I mean, the fortunate thing for me is that I can't really read it, so I try to just I don't copy and paste it and put it into Google Translate. I kind of say, hey, whatever, I got to do what the best I can to get 3 points this week, and I go with the flow. But yeah, that it's an interesting thing, right? It's something that you don't think about. There's no other sports, right? It's the football and then the hockey, and that's the focus. And there's a lot of talk about that within these communities and towns, and it's interesting, definitely. But yeah, there's an amount of pressure. There's an amount of pressure from the media on the club. Walking down the street, I'm sure people haven't been too happy when I'm going to get a coffee. At times, I've heard some interesting words thrown towards me.
Really?
But, I mean, but that's the job, right? That's the job. It's you're in the public limelight, and that's I enjoy that. I enjoy that pressure. I enjoy that passion, right? I want to. Hey, listen, if you're not doing your job, let's hear it. Let's hear it. Yeah. If someone else is in a different sector of the workplace, if they're not doing their job, they hear it. So I welcome that, and that's only going to make yourself better, I think, if you have that type of pressure on you. So it's good. I like that passion, and I like the passion of promotion relegation. I think that's in terms of development of players, that to deal with that stress day in and day out, that grows you.
Very cool. Well, a couple more questions about, you know, the current state of things there. Just so everyone's clear, I know obviously you know this and I know this, but Sweden's calendar is roughly the same as the MLS calendar, right? I mean,
Yeah. A little bit more longer preseason, but in the same type of format from April, March to November.
So you're in the off season right now, but yeah, the season just passed. You guys, it looks to me like you guys flirted with the relegation zone a little bit, but finished strong, two straight wins and very clearly to safety. The highlight of the season, I gather, was the win over first division team Sundsvall, who you mentioned earlier as the next stop for Romain Gall. You beat them in August to qualify for the Swedish Cup, which starts in February. Can you?
Yep.
This is a complicated question, but can you explain the Swedish Cup qualification and then you know, talk us through that game?
Yeah. At our level, you have to beat a few different opponents. So it's kind of works similar to the U.S. Open Cup. So we had to play a few teams in the lower divisions. And this is kind of when it gets tricky during the season, when you have those midweek games during the competition. So I think we had to play two or three games against lower division teams. We beat them. And then we played a Allsvenska team in the final of qualification. So the Allsvenska teams go straight to the final. And then once you beat them, you get into the group stages for the following year. So it's a little bit complex how it works. To be honest with you, going into the 2018 season, I did not care about the Swedish Cup at all. I said, yeah, listen, like, let's play certain guys. Let's focus on the season and moving up. And because we finished 2017 so strong at the end. And it kind of worked out, you know, the opposites, right? We ended up playing Sundsvall. So at that time, Sundsvall was really playing the best football in Allsvenska. They had a big trio of Spanish players, one of which I gave to Sundsvall, who was my player at Temple, who was one of their center backs. Yeah, I'm doing favors for everyone. You know? I'm waiting for someone to do that for me. So we're playing Sundsvall, who traditionally like has not been a playing team, you know, and they had this big trio, four or five guys of some of the top players in Allsvenska from imported from Spain, and I thought that was a pretty good matchup for us, and yeah, I think we struck first, and I think the 61st minute, and then they came back tied 1-1. And then I think in the 103rd minute, the first part of the overtime, they scored in the 103rd minute. And then right in the same minute, we tied it 2-2 in the 103rd minute. And then we ended up winning it, I think, in the 119th minute. And we had some really good counter-attacking goals. I think it was the first game all year in 2018 that we were not in the higher part of the possession, and which we kind of knew that could happen. And yeah, I think they were trying to play through us. We were pretty compact. I thought they were playing a 3-5-2. I thought their three central backs could have driven at us and opened us up, but they didn't do that. And I told Carlos that after the game, and he wasn't too happy about that. But it was a great moment for us, and it was good, especially during that time. We had about four new players in for the summer because we just sold Christian Kwaku, our leading goal scorer, prior to that. So it was a good way to start going into the fall, and we're excited to go into February playing EFK Gothenburg and Örebro and Guys. They're three good games for us to start the 2019 campaign.
Yeah, get you sharpened up for the league, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. It's good to competitive games, and right in Sweden, the preseason is so long. I think it's one of the longest preseasons in the world. So you start training about the first or second week of January, and your season starts in April, due to the climate and due to the weather. And to have competitive games in February going into early March changes the vibe into preseason. Kind of, for me as a coach, it kind of puts a boot up their ass a little bit to get going a little bit more, because, yeah, you know, with that long of a preseason, a few guys can kind of, yeah, I got two more months, I can kind of get going then, you know. So, right. So it's good for me. It's good for me, definitely.
You've got one year left on your contract. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? And do you have any specific goals within Swedish or American football?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm in a little bit of a different situation as a coach, and I want to reach the highest levels I can and become the best coach that I can in my trade. And that's one of the reasons of coming over to Europe and going to Sweden, to kind of put myself in a different type of an environment and be challenged and go through adversity. And I'm fortunate to do that at being a pretty young coach. But I think the MLS, it's interesting. It's a league I follow. It's growing. It's a very interesting league. And I would, yeah, as an American, you would always kind of explore the possibilities of coming back. It's nice to be home in the U.S. But I also, and like I told you before, I really like the promotion and relegation system, and I enjoy that pressure. And so in 5 years, if I'm in the top leagues in Sweden, or if I'm in a different place in Europe, or if I'm back in the U.S., I want to take it to as far as I can. That's why I'm sacrificing not living at home, not being comfortable, and doing that to get better in order to achieve some of my goals at coaching at the highest level in the world.
Your path is so different from what most people are doing. Do you consider yourself a pioneer? Like, is there a way that you can, like, your success will maybe clear the way for other, you know, late 20s Americans to go over and coach in second or third divisions in Europe or Sweden?
Yeah, I wouldn't say a pioneer, but I think, you know, it's interesting because the last few months I've had some American coaches reach out to me and kind of talk to me about my path and how did I get there. And there's some interest, and I'm glad that kind of is a topic of conversation a bit. I think, right, like, it is not easy, even though you maybe think you're qualified, to get into a club. You kind of need to have an in, because, again, I'm sure people where I work are, you know, when I first took over the job, they said, who the hell is this? So I think I was, when I first went over there, 29 years old. Who the hell is this 29-year-old American guy that is working with the first team, right? And we have an academy and we have youth teams, and who's giving this guy the keys to the castle? But I hope it does, you know, it does create a pathway, right? We see as players with John Harkes going over to England, and now we have so many Americans in Europe developing, and just the guys going to Germany and who in Holland as of late, it's created kind of a boom. So I hope more and more coaches can do that if that's what they aspire to do. I do think it's hard for the younger American coach. You know, I always talk about it, you know, where would Nagelsmann be if he was an American coach? He'd probably be an assistant coach at the college level. So the one thing that I do like in Europe is, okay, if you're good enough and you have the respect, here's your chance, man, go do it. And then if you don't do it, then you're fired. So at least, you know, it is what it is. So, I hope in the future, right, more coaches, whether it be in Europe or different areas of the world, South America, Mexico, do get some opportunity, and that's only going to help translate to the American player and grow us as a footballing country and nation.
All right, let's get into some questions about the state of American soccer. I assume you are still following. It sounds like you are. What is the difference between U.S. soccer and European soccer from a coach's point of view?
Yeah, I think each nation has a distinct style. You know, when you're looking, even if you look at MLS right now with the, you know, the South American movement, and, you know, I know, right, if I'm looking at a player, if I get a video from Argentina, a midfielder, what type of attributes that he'll have, kind of based on the club and what area he's from. But I think the biggest thing with American soccer, right, it's the openness of the game, and the speed and the physicality, right? When I'm watching games back in the U.S., you know, it's from a defensive standpoint, and it is very open and back and forth. And sometimes I bring out the stopwatch and I kind of track the possession rate each team has and the amount of passes they complete. And it's also because of how much pressure is on the ball. So I think in MLS or in the U.S. soccer, there is a lot of pressure on the ball. Huh. And the physicality and the endurance level is high, so they can continue to do that. And when I'm watching a game, an MLS game or a US game, I think to myself, this looks post 60th minute, how open it is and the amount of structure. And being in Scandinavia, especially Sweden, it is very, very compact. That's what I go against almost each week, two blocks of four and hardly any space in between the lines.
Interesting.
And how can you exploit those spaces? But with that being said, they're okay being into a middle low block. So there is a little bit more time on the ball in the buildup phase of the game. So I think that standpoint is one of the biggest thing, the openness of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth early in the game.
Right. Which is good, like, for the neutral watching is more exciting, right?
Yeah, I get, yeah, from a neutral standpoint, right? It can go end to end very, very quickly. I think I was watching one playoff game. I think it was, who was RSL playing? Was it
they played LAFC early on. Yeah.
And then Sporting,
maybe? Yeah.
I was watching that and from early in the game, back and forth, and I said, this is something. It's interesting to watch, to go back and watch MLS once in a while after, you know, watching Allsvenska or some of the European games and to see those characteristics. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, right? Can you use that as a weapon in the future? But are those teams that are going back and forth, can they break a organized block, or do they just lose possession? I don't know the answer to that. That would be interesting to see with some of the physical qualities and the athleticism of MLS or the American player in general.
Yeah, some MLS teams, like notably the Red Bulls, have struggled against the low block, and they famously couldn't break down Chivas in CONCACAF Champions League. I don't know how famously that was, but famously for me. But it's interesting you say that about the difference, you know, that being a difference, because, you know, one of the great coaches in Europe right now, Jurgen Klopp, isn't he all about right from kickoff, we're gonna like try to punch you in the mouth and get the crowd into it and, you know, make a big tackle. And, you know, he's not settling back into two banks of four and waiting to see what happens.
No, I think, right, when you think of Liverpool and what do they call themselves, the rock and roll football, or how electric they are, right? They have a pretty distinct style in their possession, and right, it's not a coincidence that these teams that have high levels of possession have to press defensively. When you look at City, when you look at Sarri's Chelsea, or when it was at Napoli, they have to press high up the field because their players are in rotation and constantly moving to break through an opponent, or else they're going to be out of shape. So they have to apply immediate pressure on the ball. So I think, you know, even whether it's Peter Vermes at Sporting, like, that, just because you press doesn't mean that it's a back and forth game. It's about regaining the ball high up the field, and hopefully you can keep it and score a goal. But that's one thing that maybe the press and the back line and I always say the head has to follow the tail and press. Maybe the spacing was a little bit bigger in the distinct game that I saw in MLS at that time to allow it to maybe break through that first initial three players of press. It's interesting.
You said in the past, you sent me an interview that you did recently, that American players can lack football IQ compared to European players. Can you give some examples of that and help me understand what that means? I'm not disputing it. I just looking for some more detail on that.
Yeah, I do think we have American players with high football IQ. The question is, are those guys valued enough? Mm. Do we value them, right? Or do we bypass that player for a track star? I think a lot of it has to do with coaching, right? I think I remember Bruce Arena came out in an interview and said, we do the same drills as they do in Europe. And it's not about replicating drills. I can go get a monkey to Google on YouTube to go replicate a PSV drill. It's about how do these drills or exercises, as I like to call them, translate to the game module? How do they affect your attack, your defense, your offensive and defensive transition? And what are those principles put into your exercises from start to finish in training? Mm-hmm. So I do think European players in general have been exposed to coaches with more clear philosophies and styles in certain clubs traditionally. And I think that has developed them to become more of a thinking player. Mm-hmm. Now, in the United States, we do have that player, right? I think there are, and I grew up playing with some great thinking players that have had five-year careers in the MLS. And I can only think if these guys went to Europe, they would be very, very good and have a 10 to 15-year career in Europe. And then it's vice versa, right? You have players in Europe that are good and very good intellectually and tactically, but they can't move as well, and they wouldn't make it in the US. So it's a little bit different. I just think players have been exposed to certain game philosophies and have been coached in a certain way earlier that they have developed the thinking player more so than we have in the population of the American player today. Now, I do think that's changing with better coaches, better, more professional environments in the academy system. I think we will see that drastically change. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the players in the prime right now, the 27, 26-year-old players, grew up in that type of environment in America.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It does.
To you.
Yeah. Could you give an example of something you see when you watch a game and where you say, I mean, at whatever level you're watching soccer, you say that, okay, that's a thinking player. That's a high IQ player. Like what's one or two examples of just a specific thing that a player could do on the field to illustrate that?
Yeah, I think if you look at it, right, I look at a number nine, right, and is he making runs behind to create space in front of the back four? How is the off the ball movement to create space for a different rotation or a different player to execute that space? Mm-hmm. Are they moving the opponent in a certain way for an attacking midfield to enter that space? If a nine is shifting a center back 2 to 3 meters over, can the attacking midfielder create that space and then we break the midfield line and then we're through into a goal scoring chance? Those type of things. And then on the ball, right, you see players all the time. Okay, is he making the right decision in breaking lines, or does he know, okay, we need to shift the opponent one or two more times, and then we're going to go through. So it's decision making on the ball, and then some of the decision making and the ball movement off the ball to create space in order to advance the play and get into a goal scoring opportunity, I think is a player with high game insight and high intelligence.
All right. There's been a wave of young Americans going to Europe, specifically to Germany, but also Holland and Denmark. What's your advice to young Americans who would like to make that jump?
Yeah, I think there's different situations for different players, right? You gotta have to know what type of player you are. Do you fit into the club's philosophy and way of playing? And I think it's funny, right? I've brought some players over. Now, some of the younger American players who have grown up in MLS academies, and they're the facilities in MLS at this point and some clubs are some of the best in the world, and they come to my club and they kind of go, what is this, right? So it is not always glamorous. It's tough mentally and psychologically. But I think, you know, you got to be open and you got to grind, because you have to be that much better than one of a local product, a guy coming up not only from within the club or within the domestic market. So I think it's a challenge, but if you can get through that, you're going to be stronger mentally, let alone your football development side. But I think it's different, right? You know, we see a lot of Americans that are, you know, 17, 18, and they're going to, I don't know, for example, they're going to Werder Bremen 2.
Right.
Are they better off going to Bundesliga 2 and playing in a professional environment and feeling the pressure week in and week out? So I think that's something that the American player, you know, they're looking at the name. Okay, this guy went to Mainz. But is there a different opportunity to really grow you and put you under intense pressure with seasoned professionals? We have a player that's 17 years old that we brought over in the summer that is on the Swedish national team. He played for AIK's under 19, and we brought him in. And he went through great development playing against grown men and kind of seeing what it was like during a relegation battle at a time. And I think that I had a conversation with him, and he said, this has been a great experience, even though I have not played as much as I've wanted to. And I said, listen, like, if we were firing and winning games 3-0 or 4-0, yeah, I would have thrown you in. But, you know, we're on the skin of our teeth right now. But he understood the pressure. Mm-hmm. And we took him out of the youth of a pretty big club and put him against that. And I think the upside for that, from a psychological standpoint and physical standpoint, is immense. So that's something that I think is really underrated when we see American players going abroad. I do. Are we more excited for a player going to under 19 PSV than a player going in the second division of France? That's kind of, you know, that's a question, and that's still something new to U.S. soccer fans, I think.
Yeah. There are a handful of teenagers headed to the second division in Germany, but you're right, most of them are going to play U19 for a Bundesliga side. Okay. I assume you follow the U.S. men's national team. What do you think of Greg Berhalter's appointment? Fellow New Jerseyan?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I spoke to Greg a little bit when I first came to Nyköping. I had three of his players that came to us from Superettan that had him at Hammarby. And I think Greg, he's got a pretty good idea of what he wants to do. He obviously has played at a high level, and I think, you know, coaching in Sweden, it helped him. And I think it should be, I'm interested to see how kind of his game module translates on the international level. Do we have good enough players to translate that consistently, right? And how, if we don't, how can we adapt, or can the game module adapt, right? You can want to play a certain way, but if you don't have the players to get results, then you got to adapt. You have to adapt or die. So I'm interested in it. I'm interested in it, and I think he has a good idea. He seems like he's a student of the game, and right. I'm interested, just like yourself and a lot of people, to see can that translate consistently, and if it can translate consistently, can we evolve it even more, our type of play? But I think for me, it's just a relief that we have a manager in there that's on a permanent basis to kind of start instilling his principles for the January camp and get us going again. So it's been a frustrating year for a lot of U.S. soccer fans, and me being one of them.
Yeah. Which American players do you like? Are there any Are there any you believe to be underrated or have a stronger future than people realize?
Yeah, you know, I always kind of try to look at some guys that aren't doing well, that I've kind of seen before that I thought would have really big upside. I really like Sebastian Saucedo at RSL. I really have been a big fan of him, and I'd be interested to see kind of how he does in his career moving forward. I'm a big fan of Efren Alvarez. I had his brother at UConn, and I remember his brother speaking about him and meeting Efren when he was 9 years old and telling me how good this kid's going to be. Josh Sargent, I like, and I'm a pretty big fan of Kellen Acosta as well. But Sebastian Saucedo, I'm really, he's a guy that I think has big upside, really. I really like him.
Interesting. I did not expect you to say him. He's good. He had a good year, pretty good year.
Yeah, when I watched them a few times, I was always kind of, it excites me when he gets on the ball. He's a player that can kind of excite me, and I've seen him since he's been 15 years old in the RSL Academy, and it's kind of a guy I've followed and I've always been a big fan of. Acosta as well at RSL, I've liked as well.
Yeah, I like him too. He had a tough year. Didn't get on
the
field much.
Yeah.
You've been taking UEFA coaching license classes in Ireland. A two-part question, I guess. What kinds of things are you learning there? And having advanced through some UEFA and some USSF coaching courses, what are the contrasts between the two programs? And you're going to have to dumb that part of the answer down for me because I have zero coaching licenses.
Yeah, it's been an interesting path with the whole U.S. licensing thing because I went through that and then it didn't really translate those licenses into Europe. So I've had to start that process again. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to do it in Sweden because it's in Swedish. So right. I had some good contacts in Ireland and I did the license there, and I'm still ongoing doing it. I think coaching licenses, they give you a good, especially I haven't done a US one since 2014. So I know they brought in Nico and a few guys from Holland, and it's a little bit restructured, but I think they give you a structure, right? It's kind of going back to driving school. Put your hands on, what is it, 9-3 or 10-2?
10-2. Come on, man. 10-2.
I got to drive stick shift here now. I got to drive stick shift, so I'm only driving with one hand and one on the stick gear, so I forgot about that.
Right.
So it gives you a structure and kind of gets you organized and thinking of basic things of the game and I've noticed when I was coming back from Ireland, I was like, okay, my sessions or my planning for this particular training is a little bit more structured. I can't really explain it to you in terms of differences. I mean, in Ireland, I did my first practical session and, you know, the next night I'm at the hotel and the instructors bought me a Guinness and I spoke to him about the game and where I'm from. And I thought they wanted to know what my thoughts were and about the game. And I was really taken back by that. And the amount of, you know, it's more of a mentor instead of, you know, when I was in the US licenses, they kind of said, this is the law, this is what you got to do. And you don't really have too much interaction with them. But that was in the past. So going into Ireland has been very positive, and I keep in touch with those instructors, and we kind of talk about the game, but it's more of a learning environment and open to discussion, right? Because there is no right or wrong way to play this game.
Right.
There isn't. The object of the game is to score more goals than the opponent. That is football. So, you know, in the past, in the U.S. courses, right, I didn't really have too much interaction with these guys. I looked at the manual and I said, okay, this is what they want. I'm going to put on the show what they want during my practical exam on the field. In Ireland, I think I was doing one session. It was like, teach your teams to attack in wide areas in the final third. And I said, well, I want to overload my left-hand side and to isolate on the weak side. And I'm going to bring two or three guys in the half space. And my instructor said, if that's what you want to do, if that's what you think of, go ahead and do it. He goes, I want to make sure that you can translate that to the players on the field. So that's kind of up my alley, and I kind of like that philosophy. So it is that's kind of been my experience with it. But again, right, I haven't been in a U.S. coaching course for quite some time.
I wonder if the other UEFA courses in other countries are like that too. Do you get the sense that they are that sort of laid back and sort of open to?
I'm not sure. I know the coaching educators and the director of coaching in Ireland. He's a pretty modern thinking guy and has done some good things. So I think they're more open to the being a little bit more progressive in your style of play and more open to the modern day thinking of the modern game. But I think it probably comes on an association basis, really.
Yeah.
But I've been positive. I've had nothing but positive experiences there. I haven't.
Yeah, Ireland's Irish people are great. In my they're limited good
people.
Experience.
They're great, down to earth people. They're down to earth people.
So, continuing with the coaching questions, what coaches in the world of football do you try to emulate, and have had an impact on your ideas?
Yeah, I watch a lot of film. Probably too much. You know, I got games from Bielsa from 10 to 15 years ago. I'm on Y-Scout, just downloading collections of games.
Nice.
The guy most recently who I've been following since Empoli has been Sarri, going from Empoli to Napoli to now Chelsea. And even before Empoli, you know, he started in Serie D, I think. And when I really watched him at Empoli, it kind of put a real good feeling into me to kind of say, this is how I think, and this is how I want the game to be in all aspects of the field, right? I think Roberto, the guy at Sassuolo, Roberto De Zerbi, I think that's how you pronounce his name. I've been watching him recently, like in his build-up play. I really like. And I've been studying him recently. And previously, before that, Roger Schmidt, when he was at Salzburg and Leverkusen, he's now in China. But I think he was really the catalyst for putting the DNA on the whole Red Bull mold. At Salzburg, so he was doing something different. And I always go back to some of the rotations with Bielsa because I think his football is kind of – it's football in the future, the way he thinks and kind of moving the players and watching his training sessions and different variations. But when I got to Sarri, that kind of brought everything together, and I kind of really study him in distinct detail. For a few years now, whether that's reading his pro license thesis, anything I can get my hands on him and studying him in all aspects of the field, I love it. I love it. I try to see his teams play live as much as I can. Last year, you know, my girlfriend, she lives on the border of Austria and Italy, and I was home during summer break, and Napoli had a preseason that was open in the, I think it was about 5 hours from my girlfriend's house, and I was pulling her to try to go over there, but she kind of squashed me from doing that and told me I needed a vacation of football. But that's something that I would like to see him in action. And I think his transformation of Chelsea this season to kind of put that stamp on them that quick would be something I'd pay a lot of money to see that, to see those first opening weeks when he took over Chelsea. I would.
Maybe there's a Netflix documentary coming out about it. Seems like there's one about everything.
They should.
One thing you said made me think of a question. What, like, how valuable do you think it is to see games live as opposed to watching tape of them? Like, is it that much better to see it in person?
Well, I think, is this from studying a team or a style or watching a player individually for scouting? I think definitely individually for scouting it live and on video, it's different worlds, right? You can see just the little details. I think from studying a team, yeah, you know, unless you have the tactical cam where you're over top, you're missing out on a lot of details that creates the magic. A lot of these off the ball movement, a lot of spaces where how it's created. So if you're looking at the game in that type of detail, yeah, I do think it can be apples and oranges in terms of really getting the value of kind of seeing what it's about or what this team is trying to do or how this player is.
Okay. Yeah, I just find, like, I use the rewind button a lot when I'm watching games, you know, and if I'm in the stadium, I can't obviously do that.
Yeah. I think, you know, the best is to probably, go see the game live and then watch it again on video. Cause then you can kind of slow it down and then you get the full peripheral view of everything.
So you believe coaches ought to have an identity, and this is related probably to what you just said about Sarri, but what is your philosophy? What are your principles?
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on a certain part of the field, but I think, like I said, I think previously, the objective of football is to score more games than the opponent, and that's kind of where I start. What is the game? What is the game of football? So with that being said, you know, if you are a coach, can you go forward and play behind the opponent's back line and score? It's pretty simple, right? If a team's playing their back line at halfway and you have 60 to 70 meters of space, you'd be stupid not to play it over top, right? And keep doing that until they adjust. Now, with that being said, you know, teams don't normally do that. So how can we reach advanced areas on the field? Well, more often than none, you have to break different lines and shift the opponent. And, you know, I break the field up kind of in build-up phase, the establishment, entering the opponent's half, establishment two, into the opponent's half, and then the goal-scoring zone. And my philosophy is creating, how can we create space to reach advanced areas? And to create space, you got to maybe shift the opponent. You have to create numerical superiority. And by doing so, there's different principles and sub-principles in those different aspects of the field. You know, I think we talk about Man City, right? And a common thing that a lot of people talk about is, oh, Pep Guardiola, he's bringing in his outside backs inside. Well, why is he doing that? Because he wants to create a numerical advantage in central midfield. Okay, maybe he's going 4-3-3 versus 4-3-3. Okay, if he brings his right back in, now it's a 4-v-3 in central midfield. So I kind of look at the game as spacing. How can we create numerical advantage and create space or get us into a situation where we can create 1v1 situations on the weak side? So there's a lot of different principles and sub-principles. But I like to control the game and dominate the game and dictate the game as much as possible.
Yeah. I saw you say somewhere that it's important to review principles and evolve after a game. What does that look like? Is that you in front of a laptop typing?
Yeah, not typing, more just kind of, looking at, okay, where is our team? If we have a certain team, this is how I want to play. This is my philosophy. Okay. Mm-hmm. In our build-up phase, they have that. Establishment one, they're doing what we're doing. We're firing on all cylinders. So we get to a certain point. Okay. They have the main principles of how we want to play. Okay. Now, can we introduce a sub-principle to make us more dangerous? Can we introduce a sub-sub-principle and keep evolving us as the season goes further? Right, you cannot give these players, the game is going 150 miles an hour, to be thinking of all these different principles. It's got to be your subconscious to react through repetition. And I think for me, once I feel, okay, my team is at a certain level, can I evolve them? Can I make them better? Do I see something on film or from a different coach? How does that translate into our game module? Can we start to introduce that? And I think that keeps players more honest. I think it keeps them challenged. And I think it makes our black book of a team more dangerous each week. So it's something, you can say, you can go into a season and say, okay, this coach wants to play like this, and that's his plan A, or he's got one layer. How many the more layers you have and the more layers that you can execute that at a high level, the more dangerous your team's going to be and the more weapons you're going to have while the team you're playing against adjusts. So I kind of look at that throughout six-week cycles throughout the season. Okay, where are we? Are we 100% on certain aspects? Are we happy? What do we need to introduce? How can we improve? Do we need to start introducing something new? And being a student of the game, and how does that fit into my own thoughts and kind of my team's strengths as well? I might want to do something that I feel that's necessary, but we don't have the characteristics to do that, and we need to adapt or maybe go in a different direction.
Yeah, that's really helpful. See, you've also said all players must adjust to – players and coaches must adjust to and obey what the game dictates. And how do you prepare players to adjust within a match?
I try, when I go into a training week, to give the players the book of the game during the week. And I think the biggest compliment that I can get, whether it's a win or loss or whatever, is a player comes up to me, we knew exactly what was going to happen. The space that you said, we trained it. And we already read that book all week. It was done. It was easy for us. I didn't have to think too much. We were prepared. But I think, you can prepare as much as you can for a team. But different things are going to happen in the game. It's not, different guys are going to – the opponent, if they're good, they're going to change, right, and adapt to different spaces that you provide them and so forth. So I go into each game with a plan A, a plan B, a plan C. And that might be, okay, if we're playing a 4-3-3, if that's not working out or we're not generating or being as dangerous as we can, maybe we'll go into a 4-4-2 with wingers in the half space. Now, with that being said, the principles stay the same in each formation. But different formations might provide you a little bit more width here and there. They might provide an extra vertical runner that may be more dangerous. But in terms of the play, it stays the same. So I think that adaptation is kind of what I'm talking about. Okay, we need to be able to adapt to recognize that we need to overload the weak side half space because their left midfielder is not disciplined and he's opening that up. We need to be able to recognize that if that is the case in the 64th minute. And that's kind of what I look at each week. I look at the what part of the opponent's team is undisciplined. Okay, guys, a minute 35, their central midfielder is not going to shift over. Drop the 9 in the central corridor, we break that line, and then so forth. Huh. And we will practice that pattern going forward. And we see the discipline. Okay, where does the discipline – where are they not disciplined enough? And then I'll go into the week and say, guys, right at minute 30, left midfielder, he's not going to shift over in their block. Watch. Boom. And then we exploit that space, and hopefully we practice that pattern and we create a goal-scoring opportunity. So that's kind of the adaptation of recognizing different things throughout 90 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. How much do you work on set pieces? A lot? Not that much?
I should do more. I think the best way to work on set pieces is two days before a game and the day before a game. I normally do it during tactical training the day before the game, and we'll kind of come up with me and my staff. We'll come up with kind of a new set piece each week, depending on the weakness of the opponent. But that's something that I definitely need to improve because that, you know, it can't be so much of a football purist to not love set pieces, right? Set pieces don't excite me. They don't. They don't really excite me. And I hated them as a player, and I know how they are to train them. Like it's like putting your nails on a chalkboard. But they're important, right? That's how you can win 3 points. And it's something that this year that I need to be a little bit more focused on. But I don't do it as much as I should. That is the one area that is kind of lacking. I think it should be done. Any pattern, whether it's set pieces or your transitional play or your buildup, I think it needs to be done at least twice a week in order to really be established. And you can't just do it once a week and expect it to happen. I think it needs to be constant. But I kind of work on set pieces throughout the flow of exercises as well, right? So if we're in an 8v8 game, we'll introduce some set pieces. We'll introduce defensive transition in certain areas. So I guess they do get it in those aspects as well, but definitely an improvement that I need to look at.
It's kind of like the special teams of soccer a little bit.
That's kind of, you know, hopefully we get, you know, I think Liverpool just employed a throw-in specialist, right? So maybe that's where it's kind of going. I mean, there is a big fascination of NFL and the coaching and the tactics from European football coaches. It's amazing. They love it. And, you know, growing up in the U.S. as a soccer fan, you're kind of against the NFL. Me, at least, right? And my dad worked for NFL Films.
Interesting.
And I've kind of been against it because you're kind of such pro soccer in our sport, but it's amazing to me and it's interesting to me how much European football coaches really love the details and the tactics and the coaching of American football. They're really interested into it.
Yeah, I did not realize that there was that fascination. I mean, I know that in Germany, the NFL is increasingly popular. So some of the soccer reporters I follow are also tweeting about the New England Patriots on Sunday. But I didn't realize that. Well, I got, I could ask you probably another hour's worth of questions, but we can't do that. Anything you really wanted to cover that I haven't asked about yet?
I think the periodization would be really big to talk about, and developing like not football fitness and just going into that a little bit, because you know Raymond Verheijen, he's huge in the U.S. and I get a lot of questions on that, fostering team cohesion and tactic communication. It starts with each aspect of training, right? If you're from your technical exercise to going into your big or small-sided games, there should be your principles, or they should be explained why we're doing this, or how does this, I always say, how does this replicate an 11v11, 120 yards by 75 yards game? And in terms of the communication and tactics, in terms of our fitness, we do only fitness while playing. We do no other fitness outside the field. We use periodization to kind of keep us on a constant incline. We don't overload our players, and we want to play with our best team, and that kind of sorts it. So the way we kind of work is using our conditioning method each week on football conditioning, and using nonverbal communication as early as preseason through play, and incorporating our tactics in order to, if you're going to be on a football pitch and or be a football player, be in that type of environment as much as possible. So that's kind of how I feel, and I use the periodization method to kind of incorporate not only our tactics but our nonverbal and verbal communication as early as possible on the field.
Can you, I mean, just to step back for a second, can you explain what periodization means? I know there are a lot of people who are listening who will know, but there will be some who don't, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like a gradual increase of your fitness load. So the periodization that I use works in 6-week cycles. We'll have, you know, kind of how it works for me is, let's say if we have a game on Saturday, Sunday will be regen, Monday off. Tuesday will be a development day to get our actions going. It's a lot of functional training. And Wednesday will be football conditioning. So we might be in step 7, 3v3, 4v4, where we're going to overload our players for a certain amount of times. And 3v3, 4v4 will last for 2 weeks. And then we'll go step 5v5, 7v7 for 2 weeks in a row. And then step 7, 9v9, 10v10 for 2 weeks in a row. And then we'll go step 8. So you're in a constant incline of your fitness while maintaining freshness. I think a lot of times coaches go into preseason and they hammer their players. So it's like a vertical straight line. And their fitness goes from 0 to 100 very quick. And then all of a sudden, their fatigue level drops. So then their fitness is as high as possible, and then their fatigue level drops, and they're not as fresh. And you can kind of see that in teams. And probably when we play in our season, starting in April, you'll see in June, okay, we're going to win points because their fatigue level is going to start to go down. And, you know, we've been pretty good at the, you know, this past season, the last 9 games of the season, we've only lost 2 games. When I took over the team, we went on that run. And a lot of that had to do with our freshness and being fitter during the periodization. I don't think we had any soft tissue injuries with that. So it's a big part of my program and my coaching. And it's been, I study Raymond Verheijen's methods, and that's, I really value it.
Yeah. I feel like I hear about Raymond Verheijen all the time, and, probably should see if he can come on the podcast someday.
Yeah, I think that would be a much better one than mine.
No. Let's not say that. Hey, Brian, thanks so much for your time. All the best to you in the coming season and with your career. really admire what you're doing.
I appreciate it, Adam. Thanks for taking the time. It was my pleasure. And hopefully maybe we can touch base in the future and I'll keep you updated on how we're doing, man.
Yeah, man, you should be coaching the national team in 20. What's a good date? 2038, 2034.
Yeah, I gotta make sure I don't get fired this year.
All right, take care. Happy holidays.